All right. Hello, everybody. Welcome to our first of the quarter SWAC meeting. We're going to start with a quick little roll call of the SWAC members. I am here. Joe is here. I see Tim. I saw Alan, Simone, and Kim. It looks like we are currently missing Derek.
And Derek did text about 15 minutes ago saying he was going to be a little bit late. So.
Okay, so he's on his way, and it looks like Jason is the other one I haven't seen log in yet, but I'd imagine he will be here as well. So that's our quick roll call. We're going to do an approval of the minutes from last meeting as presented by, Amber. So can we have a motion to approve the minutes from last meeting from a member?
Also move, Alan.
Alan, and a second?
Second.
Second from Joe, it looks like. Okay, perfect. Travis, since we'll move on to our next items, we're going to skip the updates for right now and move straight into some of the other solid waste management plan and the regional system study stuff. If we have time, we'll circle back around to the updates, but those will also be provided in writing to us what hasn't been provided already. So we will get some updates, but we may have to do them in writing just with time crunch of a two-hour window here.
Yeah, so, and I don't know if you need a formal request here and a vote to adjust the agenda, but I did want to just, for the sake of time, I did reach out to Kyle earlier requesting sort of a reorganization of the agenda given the solid waste management plan update and transfer station minimum fee have outcomes and have lengthy conversations in front of them. And proposed moving the updates to an email and then potentially the legislative update to the end or an email as well, depending upon how much time we have after those two items.
Yeah, so maybe we should just do a motion to adjust the agenda and then a second, and then we can move into it real quick. So can we have a motion to adjust it?
Yeah, I'll make a motion to adjust the agenda as Kyle's indicated.
I'll second.
Thanks, Jason. Okay, so Travis, one other thing is if you're not talking, if you can mute yourself just so we don't get background noise while people are giving presentations. I know in the Zoom format that's helpful. It's kind of hard to unmute yourself all the time, but it definitely makes the audio quality a little better. So
okay. I
appreciate that. And Travis, we want to move into the regional system study since I haven't seen Pete here yet.
Pete jumped on, so I think we'll be ready to jump on there. So okay. One of the things I did very quickly want to just make sure that I know some of us know each other and we'll spend some time doing introductions, but I did want to welcome Kimberly Walker, who joined us as the solid waste enforcement manager amongst other hats that are being worn, so replaced Brian Schlottman. As well. So I just wanted to welcome Kimberly to our meeting tonight. And we will, as solid waste staff, be following up with Kimberly and just making sure that everything is communicated and that we all know what's going on. And then also just wanted to welcome and introduce Kim Harless. Kim, the Kim Harless Felix or Councilperson Kim, just wanted to welcome and introduce you to your new role on our Solid Waste Advisory Commission on behalf of the City of Vancouver. So welcome back, and it's nice to have you here.
Good to see them on your faces.
Yeah. And then, yeah, like Kyle said, we'll have time at the end. We'll make time for a public comment as well. So with that, Pete, I'm going to ask you to pop on to camera. And we can start getting your presentation up and running. But I know one of the first things that Pete wanted me to chat about was just revisiting some of the mission, vision, and values that we have very lightly talked about and provide some information that might be helpful as we go through and review and discuss the chapter today on hazardous waste and what went into developing that chapter. And helping provide the information that SWAC members will need to provide feedback and either reach a consensus for supporting the recommendations in the chapter or giving us work to go forward and do to make it clearer and make it more accessible so that we can get to that vote at some point. So Pete, does that sound correct? Did you want me to start there? Is there something else that you want to do?
No, that's good. And I've got some slides. I don't know if that would be helpful. Just mm-hmm. for some folks, I know Kim hasn't seen them, so, and it's been some time. You want me to pull that up quickly?
Yeah, if you want to pull that up, I'm just going to, well, if you have those ready, I'm just going to share my screen very quickly. I'm going to
Stop share.
You stop share, sorry. We didn't rehearse this before. Are all of you able to see this Word document on my screen? Okay. So we discussed this very quickly, and the Slack members have been provided this information, but I know that I haven't really had a chance to sit down and chat with everybody about what this is. So as we go through and develop our solid waste management plan, there's going to be a lot of different chapters, and each of those chapters will be drafted by different subject matter experts or people that manage the work or have input and insight into setting goals for each of these chapters. So for this one, you know, it's focusing on hazardous waste. And so we'll talk about that process. But one of the things that we did as an internal team was based on all of the things that we know about ourselves and we know about the work that we do for our customers and what's coming as far as potential legislation and system changes. We sat down internally and developed what, you know, we're considering sort of a working document or a living document that just helps us build a foundation and build some goalposts or guiding lights or rallying cries for here's why we're doing this work. And these are the things that that our team wants to be able to consider as we go through and develop a solid waste management plan, which will then feed into work plans and feed into some big decisions over the next 5 years. And so the team, after a couple of days of facilitated workshops, you know, this is where we're at right now. So I wanted to go through the vision, the mission, and the values. And as we're reading through or as we're going through this presentation that Pete has and Jessica providing backup information as the one of the drafters or authors of the chapter, you know, this is the framework against what we're trying to make our decisions and set our recommendations and our goals around to both be ambitious but realistic about what we can and what we need to be accomplishing. So, you know, again, this is not something to memorize. And again, this will get better. We'll keep improving it. But where we're at right now is our vision. So what the solid waste system will become in the future, or what our solid waste system looks like when we feel like we can shut our doors because we've done a good job, is that residents, employees, and students choose to reduce, reuse, and recycle resources in a world-class solid waste system. So that's just sort of our vision. The mission is, what do we do to get to that? So our role is to educate the community and ensure that the prevention and processing of their waste attain the highest value and best use for those materials, whether the best use is to throw it in the landfill, or the best use is to separate it and find a diversion, or the best use is to advocate for that thing's existence to no longer be the case. So, and also highest value means, you know, getting the materials to where they have the highest value as far as market, highest value as far as greatest impact on the climate and environmental impacts of that material. And also just balancing the value of pursuing one material versus another. So there's a lot of definitions within that, and we can talk about that. But really, we want to make sure that our public has the information and motivation that they need to engage with the system for disposal of waste, diversion of waste, and then be able to continue moving along their values to continue to reduce more and divert more and to provide a system that meets those needs. So, and then just these values that we talked about, you know, as a, yes, go ahead.
Question. Can you go back up?
Yes.
The first part. Mm-hmm. Is there any particular reason why businesses and or employers isn't added into that? I know they're residents, possibly. But I mean, wouldn't they be included in this process as well?
I think they would be, but Pete, I want to check on with you. As far as, you know, each of these words have quite lengthy definitions that could go. So I want to check in with Pete and determine where that.
Was that on the vision statement?
No, yeah. This first one where residents, employees, and students.
And so there have been some visions where folks will say households, businesses, and schools, but we wanted it to be more actively engaging the actual individual level. So we went with residents, employees, students, but that's synonymous with households, business, and schools. Does that make sense?
It does, except if I own a business here and I live in Oregon, I wouldn't be a resident.
But you'd be an employee, right?
Or an employer.
Well, I think what you're highlighting here, Kimberly,
just curious to know why we weren't including that.
I think the intent was it is included, but if that needs to be wordsmithed, we certainly could. But the intent was that as the employer, you're still on the payroll, I would think. So you're an employee.
As a blind eye looking at this for the very first time, I know you guys have been working with, and not to hold up the process, but I would as a citizen wonder why businesses weren't included in that, because they have waste as well.
Yeah. So again, the intent today is not necessarily to wordsmith. We want to get into this hazardous waste chapter, and we'll write that down as a note, but we'll have other conversations about this specific document. But this has really been sort of an internal process first and starting to bring it out to stakeholders for that type of feedback. But right now, this is just like a high-level draft that we wanted to bring up before we dive into the hazardous waste chapter. So as far as values.
Yeah, and just quickly on that one, because I think it is an important point. It's basically just getting to who can make that choice. And so if the business is an organization, if we're going to go at that level, that the organization is making a choice, that works for sure, if that makes sense.
Values. So when we started talking about, when we went through this facilitation process, it was who do we serve and how do we serve them? And the people that we serve, what are their expectations of how we deliver our work and how we show up? And so these values are a starting point for how we view the way we do our work. And what types of questions and guidelines we need to have before making decisions. So, we serve the entirety of the community. We offer state-of-the-art transfer stations, material recovery, and moderate-risk waste facilities. We ensure full access to everyone in the county, especially marginalized populations. We educate so our community understands how the solid waste system works so they can use it correctly. We provide high-quality hazardous waste management options. We measure our programs for success, and we foster partnerships to minimize waste. As we're going through this document, looking at there's opportunities for us to work with partners, there's really, deep questions about how do we provide service to the folks that are unable to access it or are not aware of it now. And we need to be able to both legally and values-wise, there are certain levels of hazardous waste and solid waste baseline services we have to provide. And so this kind of builds upon those bare minimum, what we have to provide with what we need to provide to meet our customers' needs, and then some. So, Pete, is there anything you wanted to add to that before you jump into the solid waste management plan chapter?
Yeah, I think just if folks have gone through the vision, mission, values process in their own employers or workplaces, really, it is just, as Travis was mentioning, just a guiding place for us to start from, and we want to shoot for the moon. So definitely this feedback is helpful, and we welcome it. So thank you. And thank you for giving it to us.
All right. So, Pete, do you want to bring up your slideshow? I'm going to stop sharing, and I'll let you bring up your slides so we can run through this.
Yes, I will. So we've boiled down. We're working. This is a tandem project, working with J.R. Miller. I know they're going to be presenting on some operational issues after us. So the solid waste management plan is an ongoing process. It's required by Department of Ecology. Typically, we do it in a five-year update process cycle, and we're really looking at boiling it down to six chapters this go-around. And so this is our first chapter that we've brought forward. Luckily, on staff, Jessica Fishberg, who's going to be helping me present this, she has done a lot of research looking at other hazardous waste plans around the state, really living and breathing this topic, and put together this chapter, which we've sent to you to take a look at if you want line by line. But we've also pulled out some of the higher points on a PowerPoint, and I'm going to bring in Jessica to help present that. So we'll share our screen here. And thank you, Jessica, for joining us as a subject matter expert. Again, we've got six chapters. This one is on hazardous waste. It's kind of a standalone chapter within a plan, a plan within a plan. It covers all of our hazardous waste material, both from business and households. And so, Jessica, I'll let you start taking over here, and then I'll move the slides if you want, and let me know if you need any additional input.
Yeah, so I drafted that plan for the chapter, but to just sum up a few things, we've got three household hazardous waste facilities in the county. They're at each transfer station. West Van, Central, Washougal. CRC is Columbia Resource Company. They own those facilities, and they pay for the HHW collections there as part of the municipal solid waste fund. And those are from, like, you know, the garbage and recycling fees for using the transfer stations, which both residents and businesses pay. And the HHW facilities are free to residents through that. And aside from those three facilities that you can drop off household hazardous waste at, single family homes that have curbside recycling can also set out motor oil, antifreeze, and small batteries there at the curb with their recycling. And those items are collected by hand by the driver. You can go to the next slide then. So this is an image of just how much hazardous waste we're collecting from residents from 2000 up to 2020. We reached a peak up there in 2017 of 3.2 million pounds. So it's quite a lot. We've seen kind of a downturn. We kind of think that might be to do with the pandemic. That's just kind of a guess. People are being a little bit more reserved with how much waste that they create, but we're getting quite a lot of material increasing every year in general. This is kind of last year by weight, so mostly motor oil and paint, as you can see, but electronics, poisons, batteries are also quite common. Just a little snapshot there.
And just a segue on the paint slice of the pie, that has decreased with paint care?
Yeah, so 2020, we paid for paint through our hazardous waste collections, but starting last year, paint care came in, and it's a state-funded program, or funded through a fee added to the new sale of paint. So that'll be kind of, we'll still collect paint, but it'll kind of be out of our chunk because they won't be paying for it. Probably more will go to stores as well because more drop-off points are available at the paint stores because of that program. So these are the costs that CRC is paying to maintain the HHW facilities. It's the disposal costs, the labor, supplies, tax, kind of everything together. And see, last year, $932,000 was spent on it. A big chunk of that was paint, so we'll see this cost go down for 2021 and this year 22, but it's quite an expensive service. But yeah, costs you can see kind of have gone up over the years, as have quantities. So here's kind of the same pie chart, but broken down by cost. So you can see paint was kind of the most expensive. So that stewardship program is really going to make a big impact on us. And then, you know, coming up, poisons, batteries, spray paint, bases, those are the next items. If you go all the way kind of down the chart, acid, oxidizer, the others might be like mercury containing materials, less common items.
Hey, can I ask a question on this one, Jessica?
Yeah.
So household hazardous waste by weight is 25% motor oil, but in disposal cost, I don't see motor oil on the chart at all.
Right. So motor oil is something that they recycle for no cost. It's re-refined into new motor oil. So it's kind of one of the more valuable items. They don't make money off of it, but they don't have to pay to recycle it. So it wouldn't make it here.
That's a great question.
Mm-hmm. So one of the bigger kind of studies that went into this was I studied battery recycling for a couple years here. And I think I've talked to the group before, for those that have been around for a while, but batteries are causing a lot of fires in our collection systems. So currently residents can put them on top of their recycling cart, but we need to kind of change that message to like no batteries at the curb. So we'll be one of our recommendations in our hazardous waste management plan is to take batteries off of the curb and install more drop-off locations. So that's one of the projects that have come through for this plan. Satellite collection would be a lot safer, and we could have collection points at a variety of different locations. Public service locations, retail stores, libraries, you know, lots of potential to collect batteries that way. And it kind of mirrors the statewide programs for electronics and paint and lead acid batteries. So it would just kind of fit into the same kind of model as those materials have currently.
Can you talk just a little bit, because there are some sites already set up, I know at Home Depot,
Right.
Put your batteries back at no cost.
Yeah, so Home Depot and Lowe's are two examples. They work directly with a company called Call to Recycle, who provides like mail-in boxes for batteries. So we would basically be sponsoring a program like that, just at a bunch of different locations. Because, yeah, right now it's just Home Depot and Lowe's that are doing it off of their own dime. And they take lights there as well, which is useful. So that was one of the big recommendations. It's kind of the line that's in the report. So this year we're going to start setting up the satellite locations, and then we transition away from curbside recycling. There would be kind of a period where there would be both drop-off points and curbside collections of batteries, but eventually we would ban it from the curb just to keep that message, you know, no batteries at the curb. And that might fall into 2023 as far as the ban at the curb goes. But yeah, this year is setting up satellite locations.
And Jessica, if you could just briefly talk about when we set up this program, which I think was in the early 2000s, or can't remember when that went into action, but the type of battery that we were collecting and how that whole change of batteries has occurred over the past 5-10 years.
Yeah, I can summarize that. So we started taking batteries at the curb in 2003, and that was before batteries were really widely used. I think that year we collected about 9,000 pounds of batteries. Sorry, I lost my train of thought. There's a cat disrupting me. And then last year we collected 100,000 pounds of batteries. So it's just battery waste has increased a ton. And with that, batteries have changed. So in like the mid 2010 area, lithium ion batteries started becoming common. And that's the kind of battery in smartphones and laptops, which we didn't have when we started the curbside program. And those are the batteries that can explode when they're damaged, and they're causing fires throughout the solid waste system as a result of that. So our curbside system just wasn't designed to collect batteries that pose that kind of fire danger. So that's kind of the reason for the switch away from the curb. If it was still just household batteries, like AA's and AAA type batteries that don't cause fires, then we definitely still, you know, be able to do it, but it's just complicated with lithium ion batteries being as dangerous as they are.
Hey, Jessica, I had a quick question for you about the cost of the satellite program versus the cost we're paying now. Is that going to substantially change, or will it still all be covered by those fees, or how are you proposing to pay for the new satellite program?
Yeah, good question. So Waste Connections has agreed that they would pay for the battery recycling, same as they do now, through the HHW fund. So we probably wouldn't see much change there.
Great. Those are great questions. Any other questions on batteries? Jessica has a whole amazing slideshow on batteries that really is informative. You would never know, there's so much to know.
One other question with the batteries is, with the satellite program, will there be the opportunity for like a mail-in as well? Like, you know, for people, I know even now it's like for people who can't leave their house, you know, have difficulty getting around, transport, things like that, it's easy now to just put out with your recycling. But if we're going to make people go somewhere, will there be an option for people who are unable to drive and things like that to be able to access battery recycling?
So far, we don't have something like that built in, and that's something that we've been studying as far as those that can't make it to the HHW facilities or, to the drop-off points. It's kind of the same as the other hazardous waste. You know, what are they doing with their light bulbs and their sharps and all that stuff? So that's still kind of something that we haven't been able to address yet, but would like to in the future.
I got one quick question. In your report, Jessica, it says rechargeable batteries have become a material of concern for recyclers and solid waste handlers, as lithium ion batteries are highly dangerous. So are there rechargeable batteries that are not lithium ion? And is it just lithium ion, or is it rechargeable batteries that are dangerous?
Yeah, it gets confusing. So lithium ion batteries are very powerful rechargeable batteries, but there are also rechargeable batteries that aren't lithium ions. They're nickel metal hydride, nickel cadmium, and there's one more. But like if you go to the grocery store, you can buy rechargeable AA batteries. That's kind of the household battery, the safe rechargeable. They're not going to explode, but it's the lithium ion rechargeables that will explode.
So it's really just the lithium ion that are, and I'm really disappointed that you didn't remember the third type.
And it's so hard to get this message across to the public. We've been trying to get, you know, the public to sort out their lithium ion batteries, but there's so many different kinds of batteries that it's just too big of a topic to have them. Too big of an ask to do. So this is kind of our next step.
I think from my perspective is like with batteries, you're right. It's just no way of knowing what type it is as a consumer. I'm like, I don't know what kind of battery this is, you know, unless you like save the packaging or something and then look at it. It's like, there's really no good way of knowing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, I think going with the whole no batteries in the system at all approach would be good.
Yeah, and that's what kind of the U.S. is moving towards. There's been, I think, 9 product stewardship legislation programs passed in the U.S. in the past few years. There's one in legislation right now in Washington, and they're all just to address this problem of battery recycling and just trying to make a better collection system. So we're kind of... We're progressive in the battery world since we're moving on it already and not waiting for the state to make a change on it. So,
okay, great questions.
So that was kind of a summary of our household hazardous waste projects. And then I also wrote about small quantity generator hazardous waste, which is this SQG. So these are businesses that produce hazardous waste in a quantity that's smaller than what the state regulates. And this is a ton of businesses that fall in this category. I think it's less than 200 pounds a month. They qualify as an SQG, which is a lot of small businesses. So right now these businesses have no options for disposing their hazardous waste in a drop-off system. So they have to hire a hazardous waste company to come to their business and pick up the waste, which is a lot more expensive than dropping off your waste at a facility somewhere. And these sources, yeah, business waste isn't taken at the HHW facilities. So there's kind of a big gap in what we know about where businesses are taking their hazardous waste, if they're hiring companies or if they're, you know, claiming it as their own residential waste and bringing it to the HHW facilities. There's a high chance that that's happening.
Or they're tossing it in the garbage.
Yeah, and they can be going in the garbage, or there's been some instances of littering and just stockpiling on site. And if you stockpile over, oh, I can't remember the quantity. If you reach a point of just how much waste you have on site that you haven't dealt with, then you become a large quantity generator of hazardous waste and you get regulated by the state. So it's kind of a tough situation that these businesses are in. I think we can
Can you just talk briefly about some of the issues at the actual transfer station with commercial business loads? And
sure, yeah. At the transfer station, they do sometimes find hazardous waste in commercial drop-offs of garbage and in their, like, commercial dumpsters that come on site. And when that happens, they have a pretty good way to track where the waste comes from, and they send the bill to the company that kind of dropped the hazardous waste there illegally, and then they send a report to us at Public Health, and we send our hazardous waste expert to kind of educate them on what to do with that material. So we do have kind of a system in place there for when we find hazardous waste in the garbage from businesses. And kind of one of the things that other counties do to help SQG businesses is to accept the SQG waste at their hazardous waste facilities, which is something that we don't do currently in the county. So we're proposing to make our 3 HHW facilities a drop-off point for small quantity generator waste, and then they would cover some of the cost. Currently, CRC pays for HHW through the tip fees, the municipal solid waste, which both residents and businesses pay for. So my proposal was to for them to do like a reduced cost drop-off for SQG businesses. And then offset some of the costs with those MSW funds. That's kind of the idea. And it could be a flexible design, you know, maybe not at all three HHW facilities. Maybe we could have it just at one facility on a low traffic kind of day, Monday or Tuesday, do it by appointment, have them call ahead. There's a lot of flexibility in this, and this is kind of the idea, and maybe start this in a few years. In 2025, I think was the target. Yep, right there. And it would be a big, I don't know, a large benefit to the county, because right now it's the small businesses that don't really have an option for a lot of their material, and this would help offset some of the cost of responsibly managing that waste for them.
I thought this was really interesting as I was reading through the chapter, Jessica. You know, early on you talk about how the comparison between these small quantity businesses and household hazardous waste. And then you go on to say, but these guys can't bring their quantities, their waste to the transfer station. So I'm reading through it and I'm going, well, why not? Well, why not? And then in the end, you came up with this suggestion, which just kind of really makes a lot of sense, right? My other question to you about it was, when you discuss actually allowing these small businesses to bring their hazardous waste to the transfer station, you have 8 items that you may require them to do, that you're considering requiring them to do. And I just thought, well, do we need to do that? Do we need to make it harder for these folks to bring stuff to the transfer station, or do you just let them bring it just like residents can?
Yeah, it's a little difficult. It would be nice to just do it all together. We do have some flexibility, like I said, and like what they have to do to bring in their material. It doesn't have to be all 8 things, but there does have to be some sort of separate record, because, oh man, getting into the weeds. So when you collect both residential and business waste on site, they have to be kind of measured separately. So yeah, just having a manifest of the small business waste would be very helpful. Right now, only 2 counties in Washington take business waste for free. And there is an application kind of process that they have to go through for each of those. I think it's King County, and I'm blanking on the second county. But the counties that do take the SQG waste, we're kind of designing it and kind of to align with what they currently do, because it does help on the kind of the legal side of how you manage hazardous waste. I know I'm not describing it very eloquently, but that's kind of the intent behind the requirements, is to help with that regulatory end of moving hazardous waste.
Why did Clean Earth stop taking hazardous waste from the small quantity generators?
They told me that they had some regulatory pressure, and they did have participation numbers go down. I think this past year they had, or their last year, they had only like 66 participants. So it wasn't, it wasn't a very high number. And that's kind of a trend for them across the state. And, my theory is that it's just businesses are taking it to the HHW facilities is kind of only, we really don't know, but they were a good resource. But it was also inconvenient, because it was only one Tuesday a month, and you had to make an appointment, call ahead, and it was quite expensive still, even to drop off. So, Travis, I see your little yellow hand.
Oh, good. I wasn't sure if it came up or not. It's really small and really yellow, so I wasn't sure. So, just want to throw out, too, I don't know how much this is as far as, you know, why the structure of the system is the way it is, but there's also some state funding around what a lot of jurisdictions use, grant or state funding to implement residential hazardous waste programs through the Department of Ecology that we've talked about. And those dollars are not allowed to be spent on on small quantity generator, commercial solid waste or commercial hazardous waste. So sometimes the structures are set up because of where the funding is. And since we're limited on the ability to use those grant funds for SUG, it's a little easier to keep in the event where we're seeking reimbursement for the manage of a hazardous waste, being able to show that it's all residential is another reason for the structure that exists. And then that commercial residential requirements that Jessica talked about as well. So
does that mean then, Travis, this is something we should take to Olympia? I mean, we can do that. It's an issue. If it's an issue, if it's an issue for Clark County, it's an issue for every county.
I don't know what opportunities there would be legislatively right now. I guess, this is not a funding issue. This is the service provider that was providing it backed out, and we need to find a solution to that. And that is what Jessica's working on. So I wouldn't say that freeing up those funds is going to make us more available to do this work, or that's the answer to making it more convenient. I think just more those boundaries between funding sectors are why the system might be the way it is now. But nothing legislatively or funding-wise is preventing us from putting together the system that we need. And so I would say there's probably other things around HHW, including the battery legislation, some battery stewardship, and some other stewardship that I think would, clear other capacity for us that would be worth pursuing, and not specifically SQG, since it's not really a funding matter right now, related. But that's a great question, and I think how these things all tie together, there's other things we could do at a state level that would free up time and capacity to solve this problem.
Right.
But and then encouraging HHW and product stewardship bills as they come up is definitely something we want to do to mitigate the impact of needing to solve problems like this in the future. So
right. Yeah, and I thought I'd throw out there. Sorry, that was not going to. I was going to ask a question here, and that was not going to be I was going to make a comment. That was not going to be the comment, by the way. So thank you, Travis. I appreciate that. I know this may not be the time or place, but I want to let you guys know that I have I don't want to say personal experience because I'm not the person that has this. I know of a person that is a small quantity generator themselves in a small business. And this person is extremely concerned about, the environment, if you will, environment, solid waste, all that kind of things. But he has told me numerous times that he says essentially he is forced to skirt the rules and or, well, let's just say, do terrible things with solid waste because of all of the restrictions. And, like I said, guys, it's just a comment at this point, but it's just, I find it concerning that, if we, put into place too many restrictions on time of day, quantity amount, cost to the person and or,
fill out whatever it may be, that call ahead of time.
Yeah. Right, exactly. And what happens, for instance, this guy works as a general rule 8 to 5, and it's like, oh, yeah, we're open every other Tuesday at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. He's going, it doesn't work for me. And so he ends up, whether it's throwing paint in the trash or, hiding car batteries and, I won't go into details. But, yeah, it's just every time they throw up more roadblocks, he sits there and goes, I don't want to do this, but what's my option? I've got to be able to work too,
I just really want to make sure that both Pete and Jessica got that Mr. Zimmerman's friend does terrible things with solid waste. That's really what I want to take away to be here. But no, I think those are good points. We don't want to create a system in which people are cheating or skirting the system or taking materials out of the county because it's easier or dumping them up in the woods.
Yeah.
Either or to be too afraid and they just sit in people's houses or schools or wherever they are for decades because nobody wants to take the time to engage in the system responsibly. So,
right. Hey, Travis, I do want to let you know, I did get my wife to quit putting the pizza boxes in the recycling bin. Okay. So there's a win.
I can retire. That's what I've been waiting for.
Yeah, so definitely a concern with businesses managing their waste properly, and we don't want to put up too many barriers. But yeah, taking it at our facilities would remove a huge barrier for them, even if we, you know, need them to call ahead of time. We try to make it as accessible as possible if we work this out with Waste Connections and CRC and everybody that's involved. That's kind of the idea. I'm going to include a link, though. We do have a webpage. I just threw it in the chat. That kind of lists the options that businesses have currently, and there are separate programs for, like, mailing in waste that are really convenient for businesses to use, and that's kind of where we direct people currently.
Add one quick comment, or who else is talking? Sorry. I'll go ahead. I love this idea because we obviously have a huge gap with the small quantity generators. What is the possibility? The target date is what I'm concerned with. Like, when we are looking at 4 years out, you know, 3 years out from now, I guess it would be, like, is it feasible in any way to reduce that target date to, like, a year from now or something like that? Because I just see this as, like, a huge need, it appears. And, like, we were just talking about, if it's not a service available, people are just going to be putting the mainstream waste and we're just contaminating things. So is it in any way feasible to reduce this target date down to get it closer to current time?
I think that could be fair. This date is out pretty far just because I think this is really dependent on the contract and then the regional system study that Mike's going to talk about after this. So we wanted to make sure we had enough time for those projects as well before doing something new and big. But yeah, we can see how it all works out with everybody.
Yeah, because I just think the sooner we can do this, the better. Because right now there's just a huge hole in our system with the current system. So that would be my one, I guess, proposed changes. Can we make this happen quicker?
Yeah, when I look at your table of findings and recommendations, you have 5 of those items. And out of the 5, from my perspective, this one is one of the most important, and it's the one that has the furthest out date.
Okay, yeah, well heard. I like that feedback. I'm glad you seem excited about hazardous waste stuff, same as me. this is an interesting one. For our hazardous waste from residents. So one way that we can measure how successful our hazardous waste collections are is to you take the age of your hazardous waste kind of divided by the population. It's a really weird calculation, but your target percentage each year that you want to hit is 14.5% of residents. And this percentage here, so the lines are, you know, participants in our HHW drop-offs. And then the percentages are the percentage of households that we served. So last year we were at 12%, which is pretty good. But to kind of be considered, you know, peak performance would be at that 14.5%.
Is it 14.5 or 13.5, Jessica?
It might be 13.5.
Yeah, that's what I was reading in the report. Because I'm thinking, oh, 12% and 13.5, you guys are doing pretty good.
13.5, you're right, that is the number. It's a little late. We need to put these meetings in the morning for my brain to work.
I'm reading your report, man.
You keep me on my toes. Yeah, so to increase by that 1.5% is to just kind of get, you know, I think get the word out about the hazardous waste facilities. We can study kind of the demographics of who's showing up. That's kind of, on my list for projects to do, and it's here in the plan recommendation, is to kind of evaluate, you know, how accessible are our facilities? How can we get, you know, 1.5%? How can we service those extra residents that we're not currently reaching? So that's kind of a wider study that I'll be working on. And these are currently how often the facilities are open. They're really limited. Fridays and Saturdays. Central is open Friday through Sunday. Washougal is just to, first and third Saturdays. So, pretty, kind of random times. And part of this is actually, I think, part of the system study, which you'll hear about later. But we'd really like to expand those days of operation because right now it's kind of, limited to people that can go on the weekends. There is the Fridays at West Van and Central, but that's kind of something else we're also looking at. And that depends on a bunch of other things with the transportation plans. So that's why we've got a to be determined target date there. And our other recommendations is really, how can we optimize our education plan for hazardous waste? Because it's such an impactful material that we don't have a lot of focus on a lot of the time. We do bid on batteries here and there, bid on cleaning chemicals, green cleaning kits and that sort of thing. But I'll be working on, building a real plan to address these materials just because they're so impactful and high potential for harm and pollution. So that kind of, that summarizes the report. Definitely a lot of things going on. So if I'm missing anything important, let me know and I could kind of describe, but I'm glad that you had a chance to look through it and read, and we're all kind of seem to be on the same page on those recommendations.
I thought the chapter was written really well and laid out really well, Jessica. It was nicely done. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you, Jessica, and I appreciate all the eyes and ears and wonderful feedback, and we'll keep polishing.
So one of the outcomes for today, and I know we've got some notes, but one of the outcomes today was to engage with everybody here, provide the opportunity to make sure that the chapter is inclusive of the topics. We got some notes on timeline and to engage everybody and ask the questions and really, make sure that what is put down is what we can and need to be doing in the next 5 years and then some. So I wanted to talk and propose Kyle, to gauge interest or get a temperature read on whether we would be able to, as far as the actual goals themselves with the notes of timelines being a little bit different, for maybe making a more aggressive timeline for SQG as a recommendation. But in principle, on the recommendations themselves and the ability to connect the recommendations to the data and information that are being used to inform those decisions, do you feel like we could get a temperature read on the rest of the members to get a vote of support of the goals with the comment that there's some timeline adjustments that we want to make as far as bumping SQG up and clarifying some other things. But if I'm understanding correctly, I know it would be very helpful for Pete and Jessica to be able to kind of not just check this off, but to be able to move on to the details of this. So Pete and Jessica, I just want to make sure that just even getting a vote in support of the goals would be helpful as far as this process goes.
Are you talking about the goals or are you talking about the findings and recommendations?
Sorry, the findings and the recommendations. I've been bouncing around between documents. So, yes, and the ask would be to get SWAC support on the findings and recommendations with the caveat that there's been some suggestions around dates and clarity.
I had a couple questions on this one, if now's a good time. So I noticed the banning of the batteries, but are you also looking, because as mentioned earlier, are you also looking to do an overall ban of MRW and the MSW, or just the batteries?
I think right now just the batteries.
Okay. And then I think there was mentioned earlier too about rural collection events. Is that part of these metrics too, or is that, these were two things I noticed talked about earlier in the document, but then not part of this last page.
I guess I don't quite understand. Yeah, we talked about the Recycle Day events up at the top. We're still doing hopefully, and we've got two HSW events that we can do in Northern Clark County each year. That's kind of the plan to continue doing that. That keeps the HSW.
Did you have another question, Kim? I noticed you went back on mute, so I didn't want to move on if you had other questions. Oh,
nope, that was it. Thanks for clarifying the collection events. And then, just that one item I noted. I was trying to find what page it was. I feel like it was mentioned. Oh, here it is, on page 5, maybe. It just makes mention of that there isn't a prohibition of MRW and MSW. So just to make sure things were consistent with what your goals and recommendations were.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that had been a recommendation in the previous solid waste management plan to ban hazardous waste from MSW. And I think, I'm not sure what had happened. I think it was attempted in the code and then it got taken out, but I don't really know what had gone on behind the scenes there. But some counties do put in an ordinance to ban hazardous waste from garbage. We currently don't have that, but CRC has a ban at the tip floor in their garbage, which kind of goes around the need for the county one.
So does it? I mean, how is that enforced? How do they monitor and enforce that?
The staff watch for hazardous waste on the floor, and they will pull it if they see it. And if it's from a commercial load, they're able to kind of track where that came from and get back to the business.
So do they feel it? So if they have a pretty good program in place to do that and it's reasonably successful, having an ordinance or not probably wouldn't change anything, right? I mean, how do you enforce that? You're already enforcing stuff.
True. Yeah, I'm not really sure.
Other than the fact that I think when, it is the regulator themselves actually having an enforcement arm versus just the private entity, it just makes it a little more of a challenge on us to have to be the regulator when we're not truly the regulator. So, so it gives you a little bit better hammer.
And I think it broadcasts a broader voice of influence if we, certain things are banned at a certain legal level. That if we could get, on board and get something like that, I think it makes a stronger statement as far as our concern and our goal of getting things like that.
So going back to Kim's question then, is this a finding and a recommendation that we want to add to pursue an ordinance? Or not?
Yeah, I'll default to Travis and Pete because I don't know what that process is like.
Oh, yeah, whether you'd be able to get one through or.
I think it would be, I think a recommendation, I'll speak from the people that are being recommended too, is that I think a recommendation would be to explore the value. And, if our goal is to accomplish these things, adding a recommendation of exploring the value of ordinances as they relate to reducing or diverting solid waste to its appropriate spot I would need more time exploring the feasibility of getting it done and what type of impact it would have. But I think making a recommendation to explore that would be feasible.
Yeah. So to step back for a minute, are we trying to solve a problem that isn't, or are we trying to address something that needs addressing, right? If it's not a problem today, then why do anything? And it wasn't clear to me whether it is a problem. It didn't seem like there was a high percentage of HHW being found at the transfer stations.
Well, I think every day we find orphaned waste. Sorry, my dog's playing with this chew toy. Every day we have orphaned waste coming on the tip floor, and would an ordinance change that or not? That's a hard one to say. I think that a lot of the, you know, rogue operators know what they're doing and are going to bring it in one way or another. Maybe it might give them a little bit more of a, reason to think about it. But, you know, and I think the, probably the bigger issue is, you know, if you do the one and you kind of got to provide them an option to dispose of the waste. Because the reason that they're typically bringing it onto the tip floor is because they don't have a way on Wednesday to get rid of the waste, you know, so they're bringing it in, trying to slide it in and figure out how to do it. So I think if you're going to do one, you have to do the other and expand the services and provide that, them that option.
I mean, I think that can be a follow-up recommendation that we can explore and bring back. You know, if there's a recommendation or a question about should we be adding that as an additional, I think we can look at its impact and its effectiveness and bring that back to the SWAC as an additional possibility with our existing goals, our existing findings and recommendations. You know, what I will say is that, you know, not that it's, I'm not saying it's not worth looking, but, you know, there's a lot of work that went into figuring out what the problems were that are going on in our county and what we can do in the next short term, 5 years, to address those things. And so just because this ordinance didn't make the list, you know, doesn't mean it's not important, but it might have fallen down below some of these other recommendations. So I think assessing the impact of an ordinance would be something we could do and bring back as the potential to add an additional recommendation. Jessica, how does that feel?
I was just thinking, brainstorming, like I could call some of the other counties that have an ordinance and see what their thoughts are on it, or, yeah, just look into it a little deeper. I guess I just didn't pursue it so much because it had been laying kind of dead in our last solid waste management plan for the last 10 years. And I don't know who made the if anybody kind of studied that before my time, but it's worth revisiting.
Yeah. Go ahead, Kim.
Sorry. Sorry, whatever protocol is, if I need to raise my hand or something. So the ban that's mentioned, would that require a ordinance being passed that's mentioned as the first recommendation?
I think it would just be more of a waste connections ban of batteries at the curb. Same kind of thing as trying to do no hazardous waste at the curb in general. Okay. More of like a, ban is kind of a harsh word. It's kind of like an outreach ban. Like, this is bad, don't do it, but we're not going to arrest you, I guess, if you do.
Okay. Yeah, I had read it as like an ordinance. So that's why I was like, why not just make it all of it since you're going to get an ordinance anyway? So
you're right. Yeah, it doesn't make it sound like it's an ordinance, but that's not something that I looked into. So
cool. Thank you.
So I just want to, sorry, I don't want to be a pain in the ass, but that's what I'm here for, really. So I know that we've got a lot of folks that are really wanting to get into the minimum fee stuff. I don't want to rush this conversation. I just wanted to check in with Slack. I don't want to force a vote if the comfort's not there, but I want to check in, Kyle. I would like to get us to the minimum fee conversation, but I also want to, you know, give people time to really dig into this and understand. So I would be looking to you, Kyle, to figure out what we want to do next and then transition into the minimum fee conversation, as quick as possible so we can get all these folks that are chomping at the bit to talk to you about that, ready to go as well.
Yep, I hear you there. So I guess we could propose to approve the finding and recommendations with the caveats that we add something, maybe a more aggressive date on the small generator waste, and then also looking at the goal of an ordinance. Is that kind of where people on the board are landing?
I would second that.
Well, we do a double thumbs up now, Kim, for seconding. I don't know if you saw it, Tim. Yeah. Well, and then it's a triple thumbs up for, or a double hang loose for, I move to motion to approve. We've really redone Robert's rules quite a bit, so.
Yeah, we're redoing that. So yeah, maybe we can have a, maybe we can do it more formally and make a motion to, so I'll make a motion that we adopt the findings and recommendations with the additions of a more aggressive timeline on the small quantity generated waste and then adding of exploring an ordinance banning hazardous waste from mainstream solid waste.
I will second that motion, provided I can still bring up to 10 mercury-containing lights to the transfer stations per day. Is that important?
If you're going to drive them up from Tucson, Arizona, Tim, we will make sure to be open.
Excellent.
Okay, so I guess we can move now to a vote. So all approve. Raise your hands, or okay, Kim, Joe, Tim, Jason, Simone, and Alan, are you a vote to approve?
I saw a thumb up. I saw a yellow thumbs up from Simone.
Okay.
Yeah, that was me.
Okay.
Okay. And Alan, are you a vote to approve that?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. So, and sorry. I missed somebody. Who'd I miss?
I think it's Kimberly is the last one.
I don't think.
I don't know that I'm a voting person. Votes. I still am unclear what my participation level is going to be here, so I'm just listening.
Yeah. We. Okay. Yeah. County staff don't get to vote. We just accept the vote and live with it. So.
Derek, did you vote yes? I didn't get you. Okay, cool. Yeah, we got everyone as a yes vote.
Perfect. Awesome. Great. So Pete, Jessica, we've got formal SWAC support of the findings and recommendations with some additional notes to explore the ordinance and report back and take a look at the feasibility of expediting or fast-tracking the SQG work.
Yeah, great. Thanks, everyone. Sorry for taking a whole hour, Mike.
I took some of your time introducing folks and trying to propose the adjustments to the schedule. So I'll take blame for that. So thank you very much. That was awesome. And thank you, Jessica and Pete. That was good information. And a lot of hard work went into that. So
Amber, are you going to put up the PowerPoint? The final, yeah. So, folks, there's a lot of slides associated with this, as I'm sure you've noticed. We've got roughly 50 minutes. So, slides 2 through 6 are rehashes from the August meeting, older data. And let's see if that maybe comes up. There we go. So I'm going to go through those fairly quickly. If you would, hold off and take notes, and we'll pause at slide 7 before we go into the cost data, which you have not seen. And then we will kind of move through those slides relatively quickly as well. But I think you're going to have some more questions in that area. So today we are actually coming to whereas last time we brought this up, it was part of the overall overview of Chapter 3, which is the operational efficiencies and impact of self-haul traffic. And today we're actually going to ask for a recommendation to implement portions of that, the recommendations of that chapter. So that's the purpose. Today is to discuss that staff recommendation. God, I'm out of it. Sorry, it's getting to be late. And implement the minimum fee. And as Jessica talked a little bit about additional days and hours of operations of facilities, we're going to talk about the impact analysis of that and then the impact analysis of various options to potentially reduce public self-haul. So the next slide is the just the start of the cost analysis. Let's skip over that. And what we did with the last chapter in our discussion was really talked about the fact that commercial and people that are on residential services are subsidizing the cost of self-haul at the transfer station. So really, roughly 40% of the customers coming in with self-haul pay less than the actual transaction cost at the transfer stations. And once again, customers at the curb, they're subsidizing that. And what we've come up with, and we talked a little bit about this in the last in August, was that a minimum charge of $25 per vehicle and a minimum assigned weight would equalize that cost somewhat. And so self-haul would be, you know, actually paying for itself. The next slide, Chris, chime in if I say any of this wrong, please. So this kind of shows route trucks versus self-haul. And you can see at the margin, every one of the facilities is actually losing money on self-haul, particularly with Schuylkill, which there isn't a ton of capacity and tonnage going through there anyway. And with Schuylkill, just as an MSW facility in general, barely breaks even. But you can see it's a problem across the board, and that really needs to be resolved. And this is aside from all the traffic issues we're experiencing. So basically, if you look at the annual cost, and this is central transfer station alone, and this is older data. This is, like I said, stuff we got early on in the regional system study. So the annual cost of facility is over $4 million. 80%, 87% are self-haul vehicles, basically. And then the rest is the route vehicles. So of that total transactions of $203,000, the actual cost per transaction is $21. Our current transaction fee is $10. And this is going to be a reoccurring thing throughout this presentation. So in here, we talk about, and once again, this is older data. Chris must have updated this. So currently we're at a $10 transaction fee. And if they bring in 100 pounds at the new rate of $99.88, we're starting to really get up there. That's about $5. So really, we're bringing in about 15 on a transaction that costs 21. So you go down to that transaction fee, and really, if you look at it in this case, if you go back to that last slide where we calculated that transaction cost of 21.60, that's where that number comes from. The disposal on this plus HW and the county fee comes about $2.73. So really the total fee should be in the $24-$33 range. And the last one is if we had a disposal fee, or excuse me, a transaction fee and a, oh no, Chris brought this up under the 283. So this is the one slide I had trouble with when I was trying to look at it with Chris. So really what Chris is saying here is if they brought in 283 pounds, it would cost them $14 plus the current transaction fee, wash and refuse tax, and we get to 25. So you see kind of where we're heading here with these, the actual cost of doing business at these facilities and managing self-haul. So we moved through that pretty quickly. Any questions on that, those slides from the last presentation? All right, let's get into the meat and potatoes here, folks. So we're going to review the current transfer station and HHW facilities costs and data. The idea here is to examine some options for considering changes to the rates, the minimum fee structure, change to the days and hours of operations at the transfer facilities, and changes to day and hours of operations at the HHW facility. And this is kind of what Jessica was talking about earlier, the need to increase the number of days for opportunities. So really what we've discovered in through the regional system study is places that have implemented these fees, they really didn't keep any, you know, change in transaction data. So we couldn't really say X happened and the result was Y. And so some of this is just common sense. If you, you know, implement something that is an economic disincentive, that it should drive them away or have them make better decisions. So really what we looked at was reducing hours, and that likely would concentrate trips. So, you know, that's not a good idea. Extending hours, we don't really know if that's going to do anything to reduce that peak traffic, which usually occurs from between 9 and 2 o'clock. And it will cost more. Adding days of operations is something we've heard about for a long time over the years. And what we believe is that has the potential to spread out transactions across the system. And adding days of operations at the HHW facility, that's really about, right now, it's about that opportunity just to, you know, the limited number of days, give them at least a few more days at this point as part of this process to give the public more opportunity for disposal. So kind of what we're proposing is right now, West Van is not open Sundays. It's open 6 days a week. So what staff is proposing is that we would add Sunday. That would go to 7 days a week. Right now, Schuylkill Transfer Station is a six-day-a-week facility, but it's only open, and correct me, Derek, if I'm wrong, Saturday, when it's Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday. Is that correct, Derek?
Correct.
So what we're proposing is to open up Washougal 7 days a week by adding Sunday operations and allow the public to come in 7 days a week. So really, we'd have 3 7-day-a-week facilities. So for example, you live out on the east side now. You know, you loaded up the trailer on Saturday. Sunday, you can't go to Washougal, so you're going Central. And Central, I suggest you look at the webcam on a Saturday, Sunday, and certain Mondays. It's actually entertaining watching these people try and emerge and get into this facility. So it's a very problematic issue. We've been hearing from WSDOT about it for years. So this is one of our first tools in the toolbox to kind of maybe change that. So right now, Central Transfer Station, as Jessica mentioned, is open Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. We would like to open up more. We would like to consider this SQG as well. But right now, we need to study that more and determine, is that the best facility to do it at? Should it be across the board, as Jessica mentioned? I mean, there's a lot of potentials here. I would lean towards one facility and then the limited days to start out with, at least. But right now, we're not making any proposal changes to those days or hours of operations at Central. Washougal is currently open 2 Saturdays per month. We are proposing that they would be open every Saturday, adding 2 Saturdays per month. And West Van would add Sunday in conjunction with opening Sunday. So essentially, you know, we're giving them 3 more days of operations to start off with until we better understand some costs and have some more data. So here are some pretty astounding numbers. And what we're looking at here is the cash customers are, I would say, primarily self-haul. And you've got some commercial accounts coming in that most likely are contractors, that type of account. We have some government accounts. And then TAMIS runs their own collection system for residential. That's what you're seeing there. And then the Waste Connections is the Waste Connections residential commercial routes. So we've got a total of 400,000 transactions happening at these three facilities. It's an astounding number. And the vast majority come in to CTR. So what we're proposing is that a customer that delivers less than 280 pounds would pay less than $25. I read that wrong. So currently a customer that comes in would pay less than $25 if they only bring in 280 pounds or less. So the number of customers that came in with less than 280 pounds was 128,000, or 32% of the customers coming in. So that's what we're kind of looking at that would potentially be impacted by a minimum fee. So this is the customer count by weight, and that ties back into that $128,000 figure. It's amazing how many people actually bring in less than 30 or 40 pounds. It's just amazing. So less than 100 pounds, that's about 30% of the lightweight customers, 9% or 10% of the total. 101 to 200, it's about 13%. And the 200 to 280 is about 10%. But I think if you look particularly at the 200 and less, it's a big number. So let me see here. We'll stop right here. And did you have any questions about all that data?
So, yeah, I got a question. Well, I got a couple questions, right? What's the feasibility? I mean, what kind of process do you need to go through to actually get a self-haul raise in fees passed? In other words, does this go to the Board of County Councilors and they have to approve it?
It would be shopped to the County Council, and we'd likely do communication with the cities as well as part of the overall outreach. I believe this is a county manager action under the charter. We would have to check into that, but it would be a contract amendment to the rate section. And currently, Derek and I are still kind of talking about the $10 transaction fee. We'll get into that a little later. But really, that's kind of we would get the recommendation from you folks. Then we would take this to the Regional System Steering Committee, which consists of the public works directors from all the towns, including Vancouver. We would shop it to them, and then they would go out to their councils and determine, do we need, you know, to do a dog and pony show at each of the councils if they had those questions. And from there, we would probably do a workshop with the county council, kind of gauge them. And they would likely, you know, either authorize or not authorize the county manager to move forward with this. But it's going to be very similar to this presentation.
So how does the expansion of hours that you're discussing affect those costs?
We're getting into that, Tim.
Okay.
Did you not look at the spreadsheet yet? I know I got it to everybody left, or the PowerPoint.
I went through it real quick.
But. I mean, yeah, we just sent it today, right?
Sorry.
A couple hours ago. Yeah.
I'm becoming an expert in dewatering. I'll explain later.
Right.
So, interestingly enough, so here are two options. Let's go on back down to that next slide. We can either retain this existing policy, which quite frankly is unfair to the, you know, the folks that get on service, or we can start to charge a minimum fee and kind of equalize that cost out between the folks that, you know, get on service and the folks that come to the transfer station and clog it up. So those are our two options. So here are some examples of what other folks have for minimum fees. And you can see Clark County is one of the larger counties around that has no minimum fee. And it's surprising because even Lewis County has a minimum. Go back up. Yeah, I worked for Lewis County and from 1995 to 2001 before I came here. And at the time, we had a $5 minimum. And so, you know, we're not even keeping up with Lewis County at this point. So you can see if you go kind of across this, they vary. And Metro does have our nearest neighbor does have a transaction fee for self-haul that's very high, as you can see. They also have a transaction fee for commercial route trucks where they use a scale house less system where they basically have RFID card readers and the trucks are already, weights are already in there. And that fee, I think, is like $3 for the route trucks. I didn't get a chance to look at that part of the calculation. So really, you go to Metro, you're at $35 to drive through the door, but you can bring up to 360 pounds. You go to Lewis County, and it's 15 for 240 pounds. Marion, which is that Salem, isn't it? I think, isn't that Salem?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's what I thought. So they're at 107 now in a $25 minimum fee for 460 pounds, which is, I'm not sure how they got that high. Thurston County, 18 for 300 pounds. And then Tacoma is 20 for 400. And then Seattle, which is always King County, which are always through the roof, they're 32 and 28 at 420 to 320 pounds. So we're kind of being conservative in what we're proposing here. And if once again, if you look at what it costs down below, they came in with 283 pounds today at $99.88 a ton. It'd be $14 for the disposal cost, transaction fee of 10, and the refuse tax on top of that is $25. So you've got, this is where we're deriving that 25 for 280 pounds or less. Any questions on this slide at all? Because this is kind of important as comparison to where we are with other regions. Not hearing any?
Mike, can I just ask a quick, just as far as a brief statement on like the biggest takeaway from this table that you would want SWAC to take away? I know it's, you know, just to help perspective around this is about comparable rates and where we're at versus where we would be at with others, but also the reflection of true cost included. So I'm just curious if you could highlight one or two of the biggest takeaways from this chart, since there's a lot of data on it.
There's a lot of data in this whole next few slides, and that's why I'm trying to be a little more cautious about moving through them quickly. Basically, it is that we're going to be comparable to how the other local systems charge, and this is based on some of this. It costs so much to process these transactions for public self-haul. And we're really tying it to the cost of what the group under 280 pounds are really costing. So I think that's the two things, is that we're being brought up to be comparable to the other systems and how we charge. and we're trying to be as fair as possible with cost and tying that cost together so the self-haul isn't being subsidized once again by the ratepayers that are already on service. And those are the three, I think, big points.
So I got a question for you, Mike.
Let's move on down to the next one.
Hey, there's two. Kim and Kyle have questions.
Oh, okay, I didn't see anything.
No, that's fine. It's hard to see the hands sometimes. Yeah. So
who's first?
I'll go. I'm unmuted right now. So the 280 pounds is relatively light compared to all these other places. Is there any reason we pick 280? All these other ones, you know, we're looking at over 400 at some places for their
minimum. Yeah, I don't know how they got there. And we actually have defined it based on the actual cost of the disposal plus the existing transaction fee and the refuse tax. So Metro's is pretty complex. Chris, do you want to speak to that at all?
You know, how we got to the 25 or the 283?
Well, and how you're somewhat familiar with how, like, Metro, for example, builds their rates.
Yeah. Metro, Metro's a little convoluted. They keep pushing up they keep pushing down the minimum fee, or excuse me, the minimum weight to meet that $35 fee, plus the transaction fee. So, how we arrived at the 283 pounds was we started off with a number of 25. You know, with 25, do two things. Number one, would it primarily reduce the amount of traffic coming through? Would it be a disincentive to make people who would otherwise bring in 100 pounds maybe wait for a little bit longer and bring in 200 pounds to consolidate the load? So that was the first thing. The second thing is we looked at what is the average cost for people who are outside the system to get regular garbage service. And at the time, last year, it was about $25. And Derek can correct me if I'm wrong. So it's about $25 per month for regular garbage service. So that was the other reason we looked at. And then the third one was looking at that transaction cost that we talked about on slide 6, because it was around $24, $25. So those are the three primary reasons we arrived at $25. And if you go to the next slide, there's something very interesting on this slide. And you can see the customer count of how many people, with the inbound weight are coming in with a really minimum amount of material or waste. And that's the other thing we want to do. We want to reduce that because a person driving through the gate with 3 tons takes up as much time as a person driving through the gate with 10 pounds. And again, if we can reduce the amount of traffic that's coming through the system, you know, that's the primary, that's the primary motivator for implementing this minimum fee.
As long as they're not throwing their waste off the ledge instead.
Oh, we're always going to have that, Tim,
Yeah, that's kind of, Tim, that's somewhat of an urban myth that, you raise rates and they, it increases illegal dumping. They're going to illegally dump, and it's generally the same crowd that's illegally dumping already, so it really doesn't matter. So I think some of the other things, and we've got a worksheet that Derek provided.
I have a question.
Yeah, I wanted to make we've got a couple. Just real quick, I know Kim's
which
hand
one?
Is
Kim's
up
next, isn't she?
And then was that you, Simone?
Yes, sorry, I should have raised my hand.
Oh, no worries. This we're figuring it out, but it's everybody's so small. I just want to make sure. So,
so did we answer the first question?
Yes, you did. Thank you.
Okay, Kim.
Yeah, sorry if I'm just totally missing it, but the request for the there's so many slides, which is great. But the request for the minimum fee, is that in addition to the transaction fee, or would this be replacing the transaction fee?
It's actually incorporating the transaction fee plus weight.
Okay, so the so that slide, like, you know, comparing us.
Yeah,
to
you
want to
go back up.
We would be none for that transaction fee line, and we would just have the minimum fee.
Yep, and 25 the bucks. You try to get them through as fast as possible.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
Simone, are you next?
Okay. Just on the comment that you made that it doesn't really matter as far as the illegal situation. We have a lot of that out in the rural areas, and it seems like it's really picking up. And I'm just wondering, do you actually have a study on that, or is that just an assumption that's being made on the effect of this type of price hike?
30 years of experience plus 6 years in Lewis County, which was highly rural, and we tried everything, and we had free dump days, and you name it, trying to help that situation out, and they would still drive out into the woods. I mean, we had a full-on dump. We called it dump stoppers, and it was a very much an eye-opener for me. Because living in Eastern Washington, I saw some of it, but it wasn't until we got into these rural wooded areas, particularly, that it really became apparent to me how bad it was in some rural areas. And I agree, between the combination of the homeless issue and poverty in general, it has picked up. I think we read about it every day now. And so, but really, people are going to come to the transfer stations. They were the ones that were going to pay anyway. And so that's, really there is, to me, there's been, over the experience of this, it's different economic issues that drive them to illegally dump. And there's some social economic issues to it. Like in Lewis County, that's just what they did, or they had burn barrels. And so it was really, this is not going to, I don't think, impact that situation. Any other questions, comments?
I did have one more, if I may, just really quickly. So would these cost increases impact or lower the residential? I know that that's, through waste management, but does that impact those costs? Because you're saying that they're basically footing the bill in some way for the self-haul?
Yeah, no, this won't, because they're already far over the minimum. They come in roughly 9-10 tons. So they're, that is, the $10 is spread out across that already.
Yeah, what it would kind of do over time is, if you were to add 1,000 people to the collection system at the curb, it wouldn't necessarily reduce rates, but it might prolong a rate increase at some point, because it would spread the operating costs of the hauling company, over a greater base, which would then, essentially make the system more efficient and allow for costs to stay, stable for a period of time. So it might prolong that. UTC doesn't go out and provide rate rollbacks, but it would just kind of maybe push out a rate increase for a year or two.
Yeah. And this is really partly why you want to do it. And Amber, could you pull up that spreadsheet that Derek provided us? I think this is a good spot to stop and look at how much curbside actually costs. And we knew this question was going to come up, but we were kind of a little late in getting the information together.
Okay. Mike, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can, Alan.
This is Alan. I realize the data that you got there is what we need to have to fix the problem. But when you go to sell this at the county or wherever, wouldn't it be better to echelon this in several steps rather than go up so fast, so much?
it's really almost better to pull the Band-Aid off. And it can be done that way. I think, Chris, which one were we talking about? Snohomish brought it up in steps.
Skagit County did. They've slowly been increasing it by $2. When I spoke with Margo a couple of days ago, they haven't really seen an impact or a decrease. They've seen a lot more revenue generated from it. But she said, you know, since they've been doing it over a period of time at $2 increments, and they're trying to get up to $20. But she did say they are seeing sort of a decrease this year. But, you know, shoot, it's only February, so it's still very early in the year.
So let's look at this real quick. And this is kind of that concept of we want to get them on commercial services to help reduce the trips or these smaller loads. So really, garbage alone in the county for 132-gallon can is $14.56. They're not required in the county to have recycling in a sense that most people do under our ordinance because they have more than one can per month. And so really, they can get this service for $22. We pick up both their recycling and their can, or 64 gallons for $21 plus the recycling. So really, that's 130 to 195 pounds per month at the curb with a cart. And you look at Vancouver, one can a month, it's pretty expensive, $21. So they're at 26. And then you could see across the board here, they've got various, you know, rates that are either where what they call progressive or cost of service. So UTC within the county is cost of service based. The UTC makes a calculation and determines what that cost of service is. Under the contracts with Ridgefield, Vancouver, and Washougal, there's other elements within those contracts that drive up that cost. So really, the minimum fee is comparable to what they would have to pay if they just got on service. And keep in mind that the county does not have mandatory garbage service this time or universal service. So that's partly why we wanted you to see this before we start moving into the next phase of this kind of discussing what these customers bring in. So if we could get back to any questions on this slide before we leave. I've got about 15 minutes here, folks. So are you trying to bring up the presentation again, Amber? Oh, there we go. All right. And so this is kind of what we're talking about. If you look at these weights that people are bringing in and the number of people that are bringing in these small weights, the idea here is twofold. One is to subsidize that, you know, that equalize out that subsidy, and two, have an economic disincentive to not come to the transfer station with small loads, and three, an economic incentive to get them on curbside, which is more convenient, and at the end of the year, you guys are rolling out carts countywide, Derek?
July 1st.
So July 1st, those people who are on garbage service today who are pitching, you know, dragging out a can still, they're going to get shiny new carts. And one of the things we have seen, and even in Lewis County, where out in the rural areas, is folks that would never get on garbage. It would bring us 5-10 cans at a time. They got on, once the carts came out, they got on service because they were convenient. So we're hoping kind of the combination of all this pushing some folks away from the transfer facilities. And once again, you can see here, and I think the key for this slide is, as Chris mentioned, it will likely increase some revenue. And so we want to address that next. So next slide. So if we look at this, and we're kind of, that goal is to that economic disincentive and incentivizing them to bring larger loads will reduce the number of transactions by X amount. We don't know what that is, but we know that there's likely from prior experience, and I don't know if Rich was around in 98, I can't remember. The last time when we did something like this, there was a $5 minimum fee, and then the transaction fee became 10. And it did, for a time, reduce customer counts. But they soon recovered, and now we've got more than we can have. So the idea here is we're likely going to see anywhere from 5 to 10%. I think we get into 15 and higher. I believe that's probably wishful thinking. But, you know, we're going to see some revenue increase and some revenue offset. And the idea here is to increase public benefit services, including these days of operations, which have a cost, by this increased revenue. Next slide, please. And so here's what we're looking at for cost increases of what we're proposing. So the one day of Sunday operations at West Van, that cost $128 each annually. Adding the Sunday operations at Washougal would be about $88. And then adding 3 days of operations to South Hall, going to, well, should be four, but because Sunday's four, sorry. Brings you up to $237, and that is $455,000. And then if we expand the days of operations of HHW facilities, including the 5 days at CTR, that would add another $250, brings us up to $705. And I actually came up with 760 when I recalculated it, but that's may not. Chris is probably more accurate. So you can see we're getting up there in costs, but, you know, we're utilizing these additional revenues directly to benefit the public and access to the facilities. So next slide, please. So we're at recommended actions. But any questions on these last few slides? That, hearing none with the 12 minutes left, what we're asking or recommending to SWAC is that we implement the minimum fee at all facilities. That fee would apply to all loads under 280. The additional revenue would be utilized, implemented additional days and hours of operation at Washougal and West Van for the transfer facilities, and additional hours and days at the HHW facilities to be determined on cost. Next slide, please. We would be implementing the changes in hours and days of transfer stations following the implementation of the minimum fee. Same with the HHW at Washougal and West Van. And additional days and hours at CTR will be determined within 6 months following approval of the minimum fee. That gives us time for two things. One, to continue to study this SQG issue. And two, to look at what happened with the transactions in that 6 months. And really, we need to also decide, you know, as Jessica had mentioned, you know, with the SQG, should that be at Central, where we've got a lot of traffic problems? Should that be at West Van? And I think we need quite a bit more of internal discussion with that before we settle on that. And it also, like I said, it gives us that wiggle room to determine what that impact on revenue generated was. Next slide. I believe is this our last one? No, not quite yet. So once again, what we're proposing is that West Van at Sunday, at Washougal at Sunday and open it up to 7 days a week to the public at the HHW facilities. Central up to 5 days a week, but to be determined after that 6 month period. Washougal every Saturday, adding 2 days a month, and West Van at Sunday. So any questions with the recommendations? So let's move on to the final slide. And this is the ask, folks. And we're asking that you take a formal vote to recommend, let me get down there so I read this correctly, recommend and approve the staff recommended actions regarding the implementation of a minimum fee and additional days of operations at the transfer facilities and HHW facilities. Call for questions.
I just like the way you said that at the end. I thought you were going to ask everybody to buy a timeshare the way you were like, here's the ask, folks. Looks like Kim's hand is up.
And Kim's, do I have a bridge for you?
Kim's hand is up.
Sort of related but not related. So the savings from the PanCare implementation, is that being utilized in a different way?
No, that's part that, in fact, good. I forgot to bring that up, Kim. So what Derek and I have been discussing, and I think he's talked to you a little bit about this. We're just now starting to see invoices come in with the reduced amounts. And correct me if I'm wrong, that should pick up over the next 6 months. And so we should have better cost data. And that's part of that kind of holding off with CTR to see what additional revenue would be available from those cost savings. So we think from Jessica's calculations, and correct me if I'm wrong, Jessica, she's still online. I can't see her.
I'm still here.
Okay, it was around $280,000.
Yeah, around there. I think that's 2020.
We'll know more as that program gets, I would say, fully implemented, and we know what's being taken and what those cost savings are year over year.
Mike, on the calculation of the projected cost for the facility, I subtracted out that paint disposal cost. Because the way it's reported right now, it's easy to segregate those costs.
So, Chris, you actually lost me there.
On the workup that I sent you on the household hazardous waste, the additional cost.
Right.
The cost of paint disposal has been subtracted from the overall projected cost. So the assumption is that those costs will be covered by the state.
Okay. So in the slide 17, that includes the 4813 already includes that projected reduction.
Correct.
Okay. Well, it's in there. I didn't realize that. I thought we were waiting to determine that. But, we could see that, from Jessica's slides and, it's kind of complex what's happening at the facilities, as well as the costs have increased dramatically in the last 5-6 years. So we're hoping, to kind of figure that out before we jump into really getting CTR operating 5 days a week. And that might be what we said. It could be 5 days a week to the public and 2 days a week to, SQG and cleanup. So one of the things we've seen over the year with the batteries coming in and the increase in participation in the HHW facilities, Melissa and I have had a number of issues with site cleanliness and management of the sites. And so we're having some discussions about that internally as well. How can we ensure better compliance and keep the facilities clean and safe? Does that answer your question, Kim?
Yeah, I'm glad that it was wrapped in. I I think, I mean, that's good. Just, you know, as my day job with patient care, good to know that that is, you know, seeing that in action, that the savings are actually being utilized at the local level. It's a good story to tell. And if you're ever having issues with the hauler that's picking up the paint, I have three other haulers on contract too. So you just let me know. I've shared this information with Derek too. So you should not be paying anything for the paint right now.
So any other questions? So where we are at is we've got about 4 minutes until 8. And pardon me?
Yep, Mike, I had a real quick question.
Oh, I see your hand. Okay. I mean, okay. You're about this big on this little laptop I'm working off of.
Yeah, no problem. Hey, I had a quick question, and I almost don't want to ask it because I don't want to – you know, throw a wrench in the works that might, take us back, you know, and start it over. I don't think it will necessarily. It's great that we're talking about minimum fees, if you will. You know, it's been a long time coming. It sounds like we've been needing to do this for a long time. The concern I have is that, you know, right now we're talking about $25. The question is, how many years down the road are we going to go before we go, you know, geez, now, you know, $25 isn't covering our cost. Is there a possibility we should, you know, potentially look at building an elevator into it? You know, say
a CPI clause.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we haven't discussed that yet. We haven't got that far.
Mm-hmm.
This would, to me, is so what we're discussing is no secret words, contract negotiations.
Sure.
And we currently have CPI in our existing contract. We're probably going to have something like that. We really haven't got that far on how we're going to handle the minimum fee. Most jurisdictions, you know, they sit on them for a while and or do something like Skagit did where they bring them up in stages.
Mm-hmm.
And so it'll be up to, you know, we need to get the folks on board and get them informed and see where, you know, politically where this all heads. And then we'll get down into the weeds, but
okay. It'll
either be a cost of service calculation at a given interval or be CPI.
Okay. Yeah, because I think everybody understands what I'm getting at. Is I just hate to, you know, go through all this rigmarole and then find out, you know, we've just kicked the can down the road, you know, another 10 years, let's say. I think it'd be a great time. But I get what you're saying, Mike. Let's get over the first political hurdle, if you will, and then we'll worry about the next political hurdle or whatever. Yeah. So.
Appreciate that. That was a good question, actually. So in closing, are we ready to take a vote on this tonight, or do we need more time for you guys to chew on this?
I think I'd be ready to take a vote on it tonight. I don't know how other people are feeling about it, but looks like I'm seeing some thumbs up from people.
Yes, Kim, you're buying into the thumbs up voting routine, so this is good. People are buying in. Derek, I haven't seen Derek move. He might be frozen.
Are there any objections to recommending these proposals? And that we can just bottom line it right there.
I object. Sorry, I saw that on a Perry Mason show. I just thought it.
There you go. All right. So, not seeing any objections to this, let's make a motion to. Tim, you want to make a motion?
I can make a motion to approve recommended actions regarding the implementation of a minimum fee and additional days of operation of transfer facilities and HHW facilities.
Second.
There we go. Second. And a vote. So we go with the hand raising method. What do we want to do? I'm up for anything.
Sure.
Yep. Is that an all in favor thumbs up?
All in favor thumbs up.
You can go thumbs up, you can go thumbs down, whichever you want.
Yeah, there you go. Thumbs up, thumbs down.
Mm-hmm.
I'm watching for a thumb from Simone.
Yeah. Simone and Alan. Okay, looks like we have unanimous approval, Mike. Congratulations.
Appreciate it, guys. It's been a long time coming.
It has.
It's our it's our first outcome of the study, and there will be more coming to you.
It makes a lot of sense, Mike. I hope you can get it through.
Can you talk to Crud about trying to dewater the road project into the landfill?
You know, I'm actually been talking with Jerry Barnett with the district.
Oh man. Yeah. Talk to him about what's going on with their 99th Street project.
Yeah, I'll be talking to him in the morning.
Hey, Kyle.
Oh, God. It's killing me.
I know we've got a, we're at the end of our time.
We're at the end of our time. We're 8:01.
So I wanted to give folks that were here for presenting the opportunity to take off, but really thank everybody for being here for presenting. If you want to stay, you're welcome, but just wanted to give kudos to everybody that presented and cranked through some really good information. And this is the type of stuff we're really excited to work on with Slack and get some actions out of it. And I think we're going to have a lot of momentum here going into both of these projects and the things that we're going to be bringing to everybody. So just wanted to thank everybody. So those of you that want to take off that are not Slack members, but I also want to give time, you know, a public comment, Kyle, since there are some folks here.
Yeah,
just want to make sure we have time. So, how you guys feel about that?
Hey, can I ask a quick question of Pete and/or Jessica? On the solid waste management plan, there's going to be 6 chapters. Can we get just a piece of paper that says here are the 6 chapters, and here's when you'll expect to see them?
Yes, we have a table of contents. So I'll get that to Amber to get out to you.
Thank you.
Thank you all for your service. Appreciate it.
I'm going to take off as well, guys.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Mike. Well done.
Thanks for hearing me out on all this technical stuff.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks.
All right. So we can officially, I think, wrap up with the regional system study and the transfer station minimum fee and move into public comment. Do we have anyone who would like to make public comment?
And I think I just wanted to acknowledge Michael Mulligan real quick. Sorry, Kim, I saw you come off mute real quick, right? Just acknowledge, I know you have expressed interest in we're going through the slog of the process of the application, but just wanted to acknowledge and thank you, Michael, for coming this evening, and didn't know if you wanted to provide public comment or you were just here to listen in and
Well, Travis, I will say one thing. First off, thank you very much. It's really impressive all the different things that you all are dealing with, and the cost aspect of the operation and the impact on the community is it's obviously very, very significant. I hope that I have put my name forward for that at-large seat, yes, and I'd like to contribute towards that, not only in effort, but also there's some technological ideas for generating some profit out of the current operations. That's an area where I might be able to make a contribution. But thank you very much for the acknowledgement and congratulations to everyone. And as a resident of the community, thank you for putting in the time that is evidenced by all this detail. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you for being here, Mike, and hopefully we can get through that application process. It'd be great to bring a new member on board.
Thank you, sir.
I guess we can't nominate Rich then, huh?
Rick says ex officio, I think, is what we decided for his title. So, anyone else? Not hearing any. Anyone else have any wrap-up or anything they wanted? Everyone's ready to go? I think so. Okay. I will make a motion to adjourn then.
Second.
Motion seconded. Motion carries. Everyone, have a good evening. Thank you all for being here, and I appreciate you guys all for being here.
Thank you, Kyle. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks, all.
Have a good one, everybody. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Okay.